Hello, I'm Adam Bolton. Welcome to this episode of Worldview. With the help of the world's leading experts, we examine the most important questions of our time. This week, applied history. In the summer of 2021, an amateur historian penned an essay exploring the relationship between his country and its Western neighbour. 6 months later, the author, Vladimir Putin, invaded Ukraine. It's clear that the policy of superpowers, such as Russia and China, is deeply rooted in history, or at least their perception of it. Increasingly, countries in the Western world are following suit. So how can an understanding of history be applied to present issues? What are the benefits of taking the long, in some cases, the millennia-long view? The historians Professor Philip Bobbitt and Skander Raymond will explore how US politics is guided by the past. Then Jill Bennett, the former chief historian of the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, will explain how she helped shape UK government policy through her historical insight. First, Dr. Robert Crowcroft of the University of Edinburgh is with me to explain how history is applied in policymaking today and why it has been previously sometimes overlooked. I began by asking him what applied history means to him.
Applied history, I would say, is proper history. The way in which the discipline was conceived for many centuries, all the way from antiquity onwards. It's the notion that history is the study of experience, precedent, and problems in the hope of improving present and future decision-making. Essentially, it's history as a source of education for political decision-makers. And that takes us all the way back to Thucydides in ancient Greece. He intended that his epic account of the war between Athens and Sparta would be, as he put it, a possession for all time, useful so long as men are men. The Roman Cicero held that history was the teacher of life. If we dart forward rather a long way to the 19th century, John Robert Seeley told his students at Cambridge that history was the school of statesmanship. In the 20th century, an Oxford historian, Robin George Collingwood, said that history enables us to see the tiger in the grass. In other words, there's a conviction here that there's a close relationship between reflection on the past, on the one hand, and practical life here in the present and the future, on the other.
When did it become sort of formalised in government policy making? Because I suppose in the past, in sort of pre-democratic times, people took it as a given that they look back to their experience. But when did people actually decide we need historians and we need their advice to feed into our policy making?
Well, that's a really interesting question, actually, Adam. In both world wars, interestingly, the British state sent for historians to help guide decision-making, to write official histories so that future generations would be able to see what they'd done, and so on and so forth. But actually, in the post-war decades, there had been a major recession in this conception of history, largely because within the university system, political history, diplomatic history, military history, and so on, were supplanted by social and cultural history. And these have been much harder to apply in this sense. It's in recent years that there has been a renewed interest in what Neil Ferguson calls applied history. In a British context, most obviously the entry into Downing Street of Professor John Bew from King's College London, who's worked as the special advisor on foreign affairs since 2019. And I think John Bew has probably had quite an important role in issues like the war with Ukraine and so on.
It seems to me, though, that in the United States, there was probably a pretty consistent interest in applied history, you know, going back to Roosevelt and Truman all the way through, whereas in the UK, it rather fell out of favour. Would that be fair?
Yes, I think that is true. And actually, you know, you mentioned the American example, probably the most significant example of a recent applied historian is Ben Bernanke, who was chairman of the Federal Reserve. Bernanke is a noted scholar of the Great Depression. And at the time of the 2008 global financial meltdown, he was thinking in terms of applied history, the parallels between 2008 and the Wall Street crash and the Great Depression, and his grand approach to this, injecting hundreds of billions of liquidity into the global financial system, was a direct product of his interest in history.
Yeah, at a time when perhaps history is showing us in the United Kingdom and in France and the US and elsewhere the downsides of empire, we've got applied history in China and Russia, which is building up imperial notions.
Yes, indeed. You know, non-Western conceptions of history are important. China, in particular, has a long and rich tradition of historiography dating back thousands of years. And I think it's quite important that Xi Jinping and others around him have spoken repeatedly in recent decades about the importance of learning from history and statesmen, Chinese statesmen, learning from history. And that, I think, has much in common with that John Robert Seeley idea that history is the school of statesmanship. So different cultures have quite different conceptions about this.
And what should we be doing here in this country at a time when perhaps, as an academic subject, history is rather looked down on compared to STEM subjects?
Well, I think the reality is that the historical profession has not done a particularly great job in recent decades advertising its relevance and, you know, in this awful modern parlance, transferable skills and so on and so forth. So I think that there is a lot that the academic profession can do, and a good place to start would be a resurgence of the primacy of political history, which all the way through to the post-war decades was the king of subdisciplines within the historical profession, and in recent decades has been supplanted.
Do you think that populism is really the enemy of applied history? I mean, it just seems to me that you have people who one would define as populists who want to rewrite history and really ignore the evidence.
That is an interesting question. I mean, you could flip it on its head and say that actually the broadly liberal technocratic class who've been in charge and steering the wheel for the past 30 years across the West, and in a bipartisan sense, that these are the people who are really lacking a deep immersion in history and the reflections on human nature and so on, which flow from it. So it may not actually be the populists so much as the people who've been in charge in recent decades.
When you look around today, where do you see history being applied directly? And where do you think, oh, if only we did apply history?
Well, in terms of if only we did apply history, I think a really relevant model for today's leaders might be the presidency of Dwight Eisenhower between 1953 and 1961. One of the root causes of so many current problems across the democratic world is that it's extremely hard for anyone to successfully lead and manage the huge organization that is the modern state. Eisenhower provides important insights into how to do that. In formulating American strategy for the Cold War, he knew that this necessitated administrative and bureaucratic skill, people who knew how to get things done. Eisenhower assembled a top-class team of advisors. He ensured that there was a constant, ongoing conversation about policy in order to develop familiarity and expertise with issues. He applied himself personally and every single day to the issues in order to ensure that everyone else was focused on them as well. He demanded that his advisors worked as a team rather than as representatives of whatever department they happened to direct. He took decisions himself. Eisenhower's ability to manage the apparatus of the American state at the apex of American world power, and in doing so craft a successful and sustainable strategy for the Cold War, is why he's so highly regarded as one of the very best presidents, and why the example of Eisenhower is so relevant today to those wrestling with this vexed question of how to run a country.
He was, of course, formerly a military general, and military generals in the United States tend to study classical history in particular. Do you feel that in performing as a president, he himself was applying history?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think so. Now, you mentioned the tradition of American generals studying the classics and history. Most recently, General Mattis said that history is a garden of the mind to which we can return again and again. And that, I think, leads us to an important point here, which is that while applied history, or proper history as I called it, has certainly gone into decline in recent decades, it's always been integral to armed forces, to what militaries do, because they have to learn and study from experience simply because lives are on the line, and this is an experience which is literally won with blood.
And how do you think the Europeans, including the United Kingdom, who see themselves as the cradle of Western civilization, certainly, how are they doing applying history today?
Well, the British, I think, are doing a really important job here. The centrality of John Bew in Downing Street over the past 4 years, I think, has been a step change. Not to get into partisan politics here, but there is a fundamental tension at the heart of the European Union in the sense that it is an attempt to transcend or even defy history in some ways. And that generates all kinds of problems, which are not necessarily insoluble, but which are certainly interesting.
Thanks to Robert Crowcroft of Edinburgh University. Well, in spite of boasting a comparatively short history, or perhaps because of it, US policy is uniquely rooted in its past. The opinions of the nation's founding fathers cast a long shadow over America, with constant reinterpretation of the 1789 Constitution forming the basis of American legal and political systems. Well, joining me now to discuss the US's relationship with the past is the expert in the history of the US Constitution, Professor Philip Bobbitt, currently at the University of Texas, and Dr. Skander Raymond, the Axon Johnson Fellow at the Kissinger Center at the Johns Hopkins University of Advanced International Studies. Well, I began by asking them how applied history has been applied in the United States.
The influence of the classical world, I would argue, is both everywhere and nowhere in American politics. It's everywhere because the founding fathers were so deeply steeped in the classical tradition. And whether it was the Peloponnesian or Punic Wars, Alexander the Great's Eurasia-sweeping campaigns, they were all very much part of their daily mental universes and discussions in a way which I think is sometimes hard for us to fully appreciate. In Machiavelli, in his Discourses of Livy, there's that famous scene where he describes it's a hard period in his life when he's disgraced, exiled from Florence, and he describes how he finds a sense of inner peace and solace every evening by entering his study and diving into the works of the ancients in a form of intense intellectual communion. He throws off his dusty clothes and he enters the courts of ancient men where he's received for affection, and for 4 hours of time, he does not feel boredom. And I'd argue that the founding fathers, from John Adams to Jefferson, they felt very much the same way. So, for example, when Jefferson traveled to Rome in 1787, he's writing back to the United States in a state of almost mystical rapture. He's writing, "I am immersed in antiquities from morning to night. For me, the city of Rome is actually existing in all the splendor of its empire." And even those who hadn't benefited from the same degree of formal education, such as George Washington, for example, who was more of an autodidact, he would still continuously return to the classical world as one of his primary frames of reference. And of course, the intellectual foundations and the constitutional makeup of the American Republic reflect that. And when you read the Federalist Papers, you are in many ways bearing witness to a running conversation with the ancients. So yes, the classical world is everywhere in Washington. But at the same time, as I said earlier, somewhat provocatively, it's also nowhere in the sense that over the past half century or so, sadly, I think we've become progressively unmoored from that intellectual tradition. And now taking a deep interest in the classics is now viewed as something of a quixotic pursuit, whereas former American presidents such as Teddy Roosevelt or Truman or Kennedy were deeply versed in the ancients, with Plutarch's Parallel Lives, one could argue, being perhaps one of the most influential texts among Western statesmen of all time. But today, I would argue that the more intellectually inclined American statesmen and policymakers, with a few exceptions, of course, are far more prone to consume presidential biographies, 19th and 20th century American history, rather than range back further in time, which I think is a little bit regrettable.
Yeah, Professor Bobby, it would seem to me that the essential sort of lesson, if you like, for the United States was the idea of republic. And of course, as we know, in Rome and also in the case of America, perhaps, republic turned into empire.
Well, I don't know. Certainly, the constitutional order that the framers founded was, in many respects, an imperial order. Although I would say, along with Iskander, that their heroes were heroes of the Republic. And George Washington himself thought of himself as Cincinnatus, as we know, when he gives up power and returns to Mount Vernon. I'm afraid I have to agree with Iskander that this is a cultural hinterland that has been depopulated in the last 30 or 40 years. I think it played an enormous role in the lives of Harry Truman, certainly Lyndon Johnson, and now we see almost nothing. However, I don't think that we can escape the impress of classical ideas, even if we're not aware of them. They are written so deeply into our constitutional law because of the Declaration, that the principal resource that courts use to interpret the intentions of the framers of the Constitution is the Federalist Papers. And as Iskander so rightly said, they are saturated in a debate with the Republic, and why the Republic fell and became an empire was one of their great concerns. So we have this paradox. At the end of the 18th century, the framers are building a state that they believe will conquer the entire continent. And that is an imperial motivation. But their concern is that empire, or at least the classical empires, were not ruled by law, and that this was a great tragedy of the fall of the Republic. So they take their heroes not from the emperors, but from the structure of the Republic. And if I had to say that there was one great American innovation, that when we are all gone and we're the history that our grandchildren are applying, it will be the idea of putting the state under law.
That was an innovation, as you say, for the founding fathers. Yet it seems to me, if we come to more contemporary history, Professor Bobbitt, if we look at the recent most major foreign policy adventures, the Vietnam War, and then more recently the post 9/11 interventions in Afghanistan and particularly in Iraq, I struggle to see applied history being applied to those two adventures.
Well, I think that's partly true. We are still struggling with devising tactics and even strategy for a new kind of warfare. And it's not the warfare we've had since the 1860s, 1870s. And we're still trying to find our footing in this new strategic environment. However, going to other countries and trying to give them the same elements of democracy and the rule of law that the Americans enjoy is one of the great motivators behind the interventions in Iraq and Afghanistan, and even for that matter in Vietnam. The fear of the administrations that went into Vietnam, stayed in Vietnam, and then left Vietnam wasn't that the colonial rule should be reimposed. It wasn't that let's bring back the French, or let's have the Americans take over the role of the French and incorporate this as an imperial vassal. It was quite the opposite. It was that the North Vietnamese would conquer a state, destroy it, subsume it in their own totalitarian empire. So I guess I half agree with you. I think we're struggling with the tactics and strategy, and it may even be a mistake. to try to apply the universalist ideas of the Enlightenment to societies that are so different in culture and history. Whether it's a mistake or not, it certainly has been a motivator for American interventions in these societies.
Dr. Raymond, what aspects of history would you hope that we would apply in the present circumstances?
So I think it can be very hard to point to any clear deliverable in terms of policy that might have come from a president who is perhaps more historically minded and just more intellectually minded in general than one of his predecessors or successors. But I do think that in certain instances, it can serve a whole set of functions. For example, it can provide instructive parallels. It can provide a source of inspiration and emulation, a form of solace to leaders who are confronted with the burden of the presidency by allowing them to form a sort of intellectual kinship with their equally harried predecessors. It can help perhaps put the humdrum of daily activities into perspective and adopt a more ponderous long-term approach. And finally, I think it can serve a vital communication function by visibly or ostentatiously pairing their presidencies with those of an illustrious or well-known predecessor. They can better sell their policy agenda or clarify perhaps the contours of their policy agenda to the American public. So one can see, for example, how Biden is fascinated with the legacy of FDR, or even how those presidents who are less inclined to read history, such as Donald Trump, for example, was persuaded by members of his entourage, such as Steve Bannon or Steve Miller, to pair his presidency with that of the populist Andrew Jackson. So I think politicians can both self-identify and find purpose through the establishment of such comparisons. And one can hope that it can also provide them with the necessary depth and perspective to navigate the everyday challenges of policy as well.
And Professor Bobby, obviously there is an intense argument over how to interpret the Constitution in the United States. But do you feel that applied history is something which is gaining ground in the United States or something which is pretty much falling by the wayside?
Oh, I think it's definitely gaining ground. And I want to emphasize again, it's the common ground that history provides that helps us to escape the polarization that is destroying politics in the United States. It gives us a common narrative. If Hitler had never gone into the Sudetenland, if he'd never made the kinds of claims that Vladimir Putin is now making for the Donetsk region of Ukraine, I think we would have had a very different response in the West to the Russian invasion. I think that that unforgettable part of the 20th century is behind the unity with which NATO is now confronting the invasion. Scott Fitzgerald has a phrase about, so we beat on, boats against the current, borne ceaselessly into the past. I think that almost against our will, we use applied history because we can't avoid doing so.
And what do you feel, Dr. Raymond?
I believe that in the policy world, there is actually an enormous appetite for applied history. In the academic world, it's a little bit more challenging. On one hand, as I'm sure everyone knows, there's a real problem when it comes to the survival of history as a discipline within the United States. A lot of history departments are closing, and the kind of history that applied historians do is sometimes viewed with a measure of hostility by traditional history departments still, who view it as versing too much into great man history, for example, or as being somewhat tarnished by focusing too much on political or military events instead of micro history, the history of gender and oppression, et cetera, et cetera. At the same time, the approach that applied historians take is very different from the approach that political scientists who work on issues of foreign policy and international relations will take. So on the one hand, one has to avoid falling into the sort of silo of parsimony and abstraction that some political scientists fall into, and at the same time, make sure that one sort of doesn't get accused of engaging in dusty antiquarianism. And there is a bit of a paradox in the sense that from my experience doing some consulting work, talking with my friends in government, there is enormous appetite for good applied history work. But at the same time, barring the noteworthy efforts by the Acton Johnson Foundation, for example, to support works of applied history or other programs at Harvard, for example, the Belfer Center, we're very much a minority in our field.
Would you agree with that, Professor Bobbitt?
I think I do agree with that, but I would urge Iskander to look afield on the campus and start looking at law schools, because strategy is becoming more and more present in the law schools. And in law, history, for the reasons I suggested earlier, applied history is very much alive and flourishing.
Professor Philip Bobbitt and Skander Raymond there. As the UK's Foreign Office's chief historian, Jill Bennett was tasked with researching historical issues precisely so that government policy could be shaped by an understanding of what had gone on in the past. I began by asking her what role a historian has in government.
As a historian working in government, I regard applied history as helping policymakers by applying history, knowledge and lessons. I'm not so happy about lessons because every situation is different, but using history in order to feed into current policymaking where you can.
And in your experience, is this something which British politics has taken up enthusiastically, or is it really something we've inherited from the Americans who love this sort of stuff?
Well, I don't want to compare the two, but I have always found in a very long career that actually the majority of ministers and senior officials are interested in history. It may be very difficult for them to use it for a lot of complex reasons we may go into more, but I don't think, you know, a lot of people say, oh, well, you know, politicians know no history. Well, I think really that is not true. Most people, and most people in senior positions of responsibility, understand that there are relevant things in history that they may need to know. Some are more interested than others, clearly. How successful you may be at getting through to them is a variable thing.
Let's look at some of the specifics that you were involved with. Could you tell us a little about the Anglo-Polish Committee, for example?
Yes, well, that's a very good case of where history feeds into a current political situation, because the request from the Polish Prime Minister in 2000 to our then Prime Minister, Tony Blair, to set up a historical committee in order to investigate further the Polish intelligence contribution to Allied victory in the Second World War, it sprang directly from a Polish ambitions to join NATO, to be in the EU, what they called reclaiming their history after the Cold War. The premise was actually, in a sense, a false one, because they complained that we hadn't recognised their contribution, which we had. But, you know, the fact is, you could see right from the get-go of this that it was going to be part of the broader British-Polish relationship, even though the work we were doing was very focused in historical terms.
Part of this is revising a view of history, isn't it? An official view. It might be a pardon for someone who was executed. One thinks of the shot at Dawn's. It might be an apology for historic abuses.
Yes, though I'm very cautious about the idea of historical apologies altogether. I know often politicians feel they have to do that, but in my experience, apologies can often be anachronistic. But that's not really what I and my colleagues have been involved in quite so much. You mentioned this Anglo-Polish Historical Committee. You were aware all the time, the 5 years that that committee was in existence and its work went on, that everything you did was linked to the broader issue of Anglo-Polish and indeed Poland's relations with the rest of Europe. So you had to be aware that if you didn't say what they wanted you to hear, they were not going to be happy. And indeed, you know, there were plenty. We would come to a meeting and I would say, they'd asked you to look for something. And I would say, well, we've found no evidence of this. And they would say, that is not an acceptable answer. So you can see where we're coming from. You have, as a historian, but still working in government.
Well, I mean, how would the minister react? Would they say, well, we'll smooth over that one? We won't really stress what we've turned up.
As that's going on, certainly on the British side, there's no ministerial involvement until the end of the process. I would say that on the Polish side, there was probably a certain amount of direction going on from above, because they were very keen to achieve a certain outcome. I would say that, you know, we were happy to collaborate, but we didn't have an outcome that other than basically doing a good job.
And where do you get the information on which you draw up your policy papers, I suppose?
Well, that's a big question, but obviously official historians like me and the team in the Foreign Office have privileged access, so you can see whatever you need to see, even if the papers are not publicly available. And of course, and this was relevant to the Polish example, that includes the archives of the UK's intelligence agencies, because what the Poles were alleging was that we were keeping a lot of material back from them in the records of a secret intelligence service deliberately, which was not the case. But the trouble is, it's always very difficult to prove a negative.
You also looked into very, very controversial cases in the history of these islands. I mean, the case of Roger Casement,
yes,
for example, and that involved reading so-called black diaries.
Yes, I did do that. And again, that's another classic case of the applied history side, if you like, because at the time when there was a particular conference held in Dublin, again in 2000 as it happened, that was in the context of negotiations going on between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland and the British government.
I mean, he was an Irish nationalist who was executed for treason.
Roger Casement was a British colonial civil servant, but also an Irish nationalist who, during the First World War, was trying to encourage a German brigade and indeed was involved in the Easter Rising, was arrested and executed for treason. Where the controversy arose was because when he was arrested, diaries were found in his lodgings with graphic accounts of homosexual encounters with young boys during his career. And this all became a politically charged subject in the context of Anglo-Irish relations, with a lot of allegations that British intelligence must have forged these diaries because it couldn't be true the Irish nationalist hero would have this kind of thing in his past, until in fact the diaries were scientifically proved to be genuine, which was some time later. It was a controversial issue, which as historians you're kind of in the middle of, and again, with access to papers that others couldn't see.
And what I understand for this, your appliance of history is looking at past controversies and trying to sort of iron them out to a certain...
Yeah, I mean, most current policy issues, in fact, have in their past somewhere an element of historical controversy. Think, for example, about current Russian arguments about what may or may not have been said just after the fall of the Soviet Union. I mean, there are always controversies where people in power in other countries try to use history to say, well, you did this or you didn't do that or whatever it is. Now, you can never fully lay controversies to rest, but it's always been part of our job to investigate them and explain as far as you can what actually happened in order to help current policymakers deal with what happens.
Two final questions. The first is, do you ever find yourself saying to policymakers, I wouldn't do that if I were you, because history shows us that's how it would go?
That's absolutely not how it works. And you couldn't, it would be presumptuous, I think, for us as historians to do that. What you can do is say, and, you know, for example, even last year when I was still working with the Foreign Office, I was asked to provide examples of certain things that had happened in the past, which may repeat themselves in the context of the Ukraine conflict. And there your job is to say, well, this is how it was dealt with at a particular time. These are some issues that you might like to consider when dealing with this problem. Every minister has a huge amount of things to take into account when they're considering policymaking. And all you can do is to inject some, with luck, useful comments about things in the past which can feed in.
That was Jill Bennett, doyenne of the British government's historical advisers. No less a figure than Henry Kissinger once warned that history is not a cookbook offering pre-tested recipes, but it is, so far, the best and only guide we have for the present and, what's more, for the future. Looking back may well be the best way of getting ahead. This has been Worldview on Engelsberg Ideas. Engelsberg Ideas is funded by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation for Public Benefit. Murray Jessel is the series producer. Eve Webster is the producer, and the sound engineer is Gareth Jones. And if you enjoyed this episode of Worldview, please subscribe and rate our podcast. You can also visit engelsbergideas.com for more podcasts and thought-provoking writing. I'm Adam Bolton. Until next time, thanks for listening.